Have you ever, like, stared at a menu or maybe a shelf full of electronics and just wondered what really makes you pick one thing over another? It's clearly not just about the price tag, right? There's something else. It's that feeling you get from buying something, that satisfaction, that benefit. We all kind of chase it without really thinking, but how much satisfaction does that first amazing bite of chocolate really give you compared to, say, the fifth bite? Well, today we're taking a deep dive into your sources on this really fundamental idea in economics called utility. Our mission basically is to unpack what utility means, how economists think it works, and crucially, where this neat theory bumps up against, well, the real world. The goal is for you to come away understanding a bit more about what drives consumer choices, maybe even your own.
And that understanding is, yeah, absolutely key. Because if you don't get your head around utility, it's much harder to really grasp why people make the economic decisions they do, or understand the forces behind demand. Like you said, it really is about more than just the money. It's about perceived value, the satisfaction you get or think you'll get.
Right. So when economists talk about utility, it's not just jargon. They're trying to put a label on that, well, that satisfaction or benefit we get from consuming things, goods, services, whatever, is pretty central to how they model consumer choice. But okay, how on earth do you measure something that's so subjective, so personal?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because it is subjective. But for, building theories, economists have ways to conceptualize it. First, there's total utility. Think of it as the grand total of satisfaction you get from consuming a certain amount of something. Generally, the more you consume, the higher your total utility. Makes sense. But, and this is important, it usually rises at a decreasing rate. Then, maybe even more useful, is marginal utility. Marginal just means the additional bit. So the extra satisfaction you get from consuming just one more unit. Think about that first square of really good chocolate. Huge marginal utility, right?
Yeah.
Pure joy. The second square, still good, probably. But the extra joy, maybe a little less intense. Your total satisfaction is still going up, but that marginal kick is smaller. And just for completeness, there's average utility too. That's just total utility divided by how many units you had. Utility per unit, basically. Now, for analysis, we sometimes talk about hypothetical utils like units of satisfaction, but it's super important to remember this is a theoretical tool, a concept. We can't actually hook someone up to a machine and measure their utils. It's not like temperature or weight. That's why a lot of modern economics focuses more on ordinal utility, just ranking preferences. I prefer A to B. Not how much more I prefer A.
Okay, that decreasing rate thing you mentioned, that feels really intuitive. It leads perfectly into this really foundational concept, doesn't it? The law of diminishing marginal utility sounds important.
It is. It's absolutely fundamental. The law basically states that as you consume more and more units of one particular good, and this is key, assuming your consumption of other stuff stays the same, the extra satisfaction, the marginal utility you get from each additional unit starts to fall. Your sources use that chocolate bar example, which is perfect. That first bar, amazing. High satisfaction, high marginal utility. The second one, pretty good, maybe. But the added satisfaction, less than the first. By the third or fourth, much less added benefit. Eventually, you might hit a point where another bar gives you zero extra satisfaction or even negative utility, like you actually feel worse, you feel sick. It totally explains why those all-you-can-eat buffets are often a bad deal for the restaurant after the first plate. That first plate is heaven, the second, all right, the third, you're pushing through, The marginal utility has plummeted.
That's so true. I've definitely been there. And, okay, if that extra satisfaction keeps dropping, it makes total sense that what you're willing to pay for that next unit would also drop, yeah? Is that the direct link? Why demand curves slope downwards? Because businesses seem to get this, even if they don't call it marginal utility. Think about like value meals or bundles on streaming services. The first movie you watch gives you a lot of bang for your buck, maybe. The 10th one. Less additional value, so they package them. Or even like why a single scoop of ice cream often costs proportionally more per scoop than getting two scoops. They're kind of pricing based on that drop-off.
Exactly. You've nailed the implication that diminishing marginal utility directly influences our willingness to pay, which in turn shapes the demand curve.
Okay, so that covers satisfaction from one thing. But reality check, we don't just buy one thing. And crucially, we don't have infinite money, sadly. So how do we as consumers juggle all these different potential purchases with our limited budget to get the maximum possible overall satisfaction? Is there like a secret formula for happiness when you're comparison shopping? This must be where that equimarginal principle comes in.
Precisely. The equimarginal principle, or sometimes called the law of equimarginal utility. It addresses exactly that challenge. allocating a limited income across various goods to get the most total satisfaction, the most bang for your buck overall. The core idea, it sounds a bit technical maybe, but it's intuitive when you break it down. It says you maximize your total utility when the marginal utility you get per dollar, or whatever currency spent, is the same for all the goods you buy. So the formula looks like MU rho, MEO rho, MEO rhos, and so on for all goods. MU is marginal utility, P is price. Let's say the last dollar you spent on coffee gave you more marginal utility than the last dollar you spent on, I don't know, cookies. Well, the principle says you should shift some spending. Buy a bit more coffee, a few less cookies, until that utility per dollar ratio balances out for both. MU of coffee. Price of coffee should equal MU of cookies, price of cookies. Now, obviously, we don't walk around doing these calculations consciously for every single purchase. It sounds exhausting and maybe a bit too robotic.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a lot of mental math for buying groceries.
Right. But the theory suggests this is the underlying logic of rational choice. And, like all theories, it rests on some assumptions. It assumes we are rational maximizers, that goods can be divided into small units for these marginal adjustments, that our income isn't changing while we decide, and prices are stable too. Big assumptions.
Okay, so let's connect the dots then. We've got diminishing satisfaction from one good, and this idea of balancing the satisfaction per dollar across different goods. How does all that actually build the demand curve we see in textbooks? That simple downward slope. How does it explain my choices when I'm deciding whether to buy, say, another pair of shoes?
It brings it all together quite neatly, actually. The individual demand curve showing how much you would buy at different prices comes directly from these two ideas, diminishing marginal utility and the equal marginal principle. Think about it. If the price of those shoes falls, then the marginal utility per dollar spent on shoes, M shoes, P shoes, suddenly increases. That ratio gets bigger because the price P went down. This makes shoes look like a better deal compared to other things you could spend your money on where the MUP ratio hasn't changed. So, following the equal marginal principle, you're prompted to reallocate your budget. You buy more shoes until the marginal utility you get from the last pair of shoes drops enough, because of diminishing returns, to bring that MUP ratio back into balance with other goods. So lower price leads to buying more quantity. That's your downward sloping demand curve right there. And economists usually break down why you buy more into two effects. There's the substitution effect. The shoes are now relatively cheaper than other things, so you substitute towards shoes. And the income effect. The lower price effectively means your existing income can buy more stuff overall, like you got a small raise.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that extra real income might go towards buying more shoes.
Okay, that makes sense. It paints a very elegant, logical picture of consumer choice.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is a big but, isn't it? How well does this neat theory actually hold up in the messy reality of everyday life? I mean, are we always that rational? Do we really calculate MU per dollar?
Yeah, that's where we need to be critical. It's a foundational theory, incredibly useful for thinking about the basics.
Yeah.
But it definitely has some significant real-world limitations. Your sources point these out quite clearly. First, the big one we touched on, utility is subjective. And you can't really measure it cardinally with precise numbers. The whole idea of utils is a theoretical crutch. It varies wildly person to person, situation to situation. Second, that assumption of perfect rationality, it's a big ask. Real people are influenced by habits, emotions, advertising, what our friends are doing, impulse, not just cold, hard utility calculations.
Impulse buys, a nemesis. Definitely not maximizing my utility there sometimes.
Exactly. Third, the theory often assumes the marginal utility of money itself is constant. But think about it. An extra $10 means a lot more to someone barely scraping by than it does to a millionaire. So the utility of money itself changes. Then there's the issue of indivisible goods. You can't easily buy a fraction of a car or a fridge to perfectly equalize your marginal utility per dollar. You buy one, or you don't.
Right. You can't just buy 0.7 of a washing machine.
Precisely.
No.
And finally, the theory is often static. It assumes our tastes, preferences, income, they all stay the same while we're making this decision. But in reality, our tastes change, we get pay rises or lose jobs, new products come out. It's all constantly shifting. Oh, and one more, it often ignores externalities. It focuses purely on your private satisfaction, not the impact on others or the environment.
Wow, okay. So quite a few caveats there. But despite all those criticisms, it sounds like the core ideas, especially diminishing returns and thinking about trade-offs, still give us a valuable way to frame consumer behavior. Even if it's not a perfect predictor, it helps us understand the basic mechanics of demand.
I think that's the right takeaway. It's a model. And like all models, it simplifies reality. It doesn't capture everything, far from it. But it provides a really useful framework, a starting point for understanding why demand curves slope down and how people, in theory, make choices under scarcity. And, you know, it does make you think.
Yeah. Well, it raises this interesting question, doesn't it? If utility is so subjective, so easily swayed by things like emotion, advertising, social media trends, does that stuff actually change our fundamental underlying satisfaction? Or does it just change our perception of what will bring us satisfaction? And how does that subtle difference maybe influence the choices you make, perhaps without even realizing it, every single day?
Perception versus reality and satisfaction. That is definitely something to chew on. What a great thought to end on. Thank you so much for walking us through that, and thank you for joining us on this deep dive into utility. We hope you'll keep exploring these fascinating ideas in economics.